Hello and welcome back to Catching Up on Capitol Hill, a series in which we discuss the latest in tax legislation and in tax policy. I'm your host, John Gimigliano. Well, folks, we finally have a bill. Actual legislative text. Text that we can read, we can ponder, and of course, we can discuss, which is what we're going to do today. We've been a little bit stuck over the last 2 weeks on the podcast on what to say until we got the bill, of course. Any speculation that we would have done would have been soon outdated by reality. Well, that reality is now upon us. The bill has been released. And suddenly there is so much to say, and we're excited to talk to you about some of these individual pieces of the One Big Beautiful Bill, as it's known, that was released earlier this week by the Ways and Means Committee. Now, before I say another word, just your regular reminder, we are not here to say what Congress should or should not do, what is good or not good policy. We're just simply here to say what is. So just remember, we are legislative Switzerland on this podcast. And with that caveat, let's just move into what we wanted to discuss today. And that is a discussion, a proposal in this legislation that really we wanted to talk to you about for a while. But really, that was hard to do until we actually got the bill and the text. What I'm talking about are the retaliatory measures included in new proposed Section 899. This is such an interesting provision in the world of international taxation, and I'm excited to talk to you about it today and to talk to you about it with two fresh voices on the podcast. One is Danielle Rolfes, who's joined us before, but it's been a while. Danielle, as you likely know, is a prominent figure in the world of tax policy, not only having previously been International Tax Counsel in Treasury's Office of Tax Policy, but also as head of KPMG's Washington National Tax Office. The second is a voice you have not yet heard from on this podcast, and that is Alistair Pepper. Alistair is a managing director in the Washington National Tax Office, KPMG, and before joining us was a policy advisor at the OECD and also at HMT. So this is a topic that Alistair has been thinking a lot about, as you can imagine, and we're ready to get his take. Okay, Alistair, the first question is for you. So this new proposed Section 899, I guess it's arguably designed to retaliate against certain taxes enacted by other jurisdictions. What kind of taxes are we talking about that we're retaliating against? And is there something unique about them or something that they all have in common? Let us know.
This is going after unfair foreign taxes as defined by Section 899. What are those? Well, the bill identifies three taxes that are definitely unfair. One is the under-tax profits rule, or the UTPR. This is the backstop to the Pillar 2 rules that give other countries taxing rights over entities that they have no ownership interest in. So similar to a CFC rule, but really a reverse CFC rule. We've got DSTs, or digital services taxes. These are taxes that countries, particularly in Europe, have introduced that give them taxing rights over things like social media search, really hitting the big US tech companies. And finally, we've got the diverted profits tax, or DPT. This is a measure that is designed to give countries, notably the UK and Australia, taxing rights over things that they wouldn't get taxing rights over under their existing tax rules. These taxes are things that approximately 30 countries have. We've got Canada, we've got Australia, we've got most of the EU, we've got the UK, we've got South Korea, and we've got Japan, though Japan's UTPR kicks in later, and so this isn't something that applies to Japan today. The bill also provides that there are other taxes defined as extraterritorial or discriminatory that could also be brought into scope, and provides the Treasury Secretary with the ability to identify those taxes. So there are other things that we could see coming into play, particularly thinking about things like withholding tax on services, which the UN is exploring as part of its work on tax.
So three specific taxes enumerated in the proposed 899, plus whatever Treasury might additionally add. So for those of you who are listening home, that was a lot of acronyms. But if you've been following along with Pillar 2, you probably know what UTPR is. Digital services tax has been in the news for years. Deferred profits tax, maybe slightly less. But let's just put this in a little bit of context. Perhaps you're uniquely positioned to answer this one. But would it be fair to say the UK would be a three-time loser under 899?
The UK would be a three-time loser, and we've got a couple of two-time losers in there: Australia, France, Spain, Italy.
This is complex in that it's not just any one tax. For example, if you're a UK multinational, you're looking at this, the solution out of this is not that simple, because it's not just merely air quote fixing that we could talk about just one single tax. It's potentially more than one.
I think that makes it quite difficult for countries where they've got two or three taxes that they would need to remove to get out of this measure. You've got to think quite carefully before you remove one, because if you're not willing to remove the other one, there's no real benefit to taking the UTPR off the table if you really want to keep your DST.
Right. That sort of sets up these negotiations that this might trigger to be really interesting, different countries having different negotiating positions. So Danielle, let me bring you in here. Now we know what it is that Congress isn't happy about, but tell us why. What is it that they seem to be upset about how these specific taxes apply to the U.S.?
All three of the taxes that Alistair identified as being the immediate target of this proposal would fit the description of extraterritorial taxes. The under-tax profits rule, and John, I'm going to try to avoid the acronyms, but keep me honest. The under-tax profits rule, as Alistair pointed out, is a taxing right that is the backstop to the Pillar 2 rules that would allow a sister company to tax the profits of another sister company. So not based on any ownership interest, not based on CFC rules. And many practitioners have pointed out that this would seem to violate our tax treaties, which have provisions to identify when there are taxing rights of another entity's profits. For example, Article 9 of our tax treaties tells us how to allocate profits between two related entities. And Article 7 tells us when one legal entity has a taxable nexus in another jurisdiction because it's operating through a permanent establishment. So our treaties have very carefully delineated the taxing rights of different legal entities in jurisdictions. And the under-tax profits rule comes on top of that and creates a unique new taxing rights that one can pretty easily argue is in contravention of those tax treaties. The digital services taxes we've talked about for a long time seem designed to tax the profits of the U.S. digital giants. And that was viewed as a feature in their design. I think Bruno Le Maire came pretty close to coming out and say, hey, one of the really cool features of this tax is that it's just going to tax U.S. multinationals and won't tax French companies. So it's extraterritorial in the sense that it's taxing profits that our tax treaties wouldn't view as having a nexus to the market jurisdiction. But I think it's also discriminatory in that it was a tax designed to get at an industry where U.S. multinationals really dominate. And as you pointed, maybe the most obscure of these is the diverted profits tax. But I will admit that that one particularly gets my blood pressure up because the UK kind of started the diverted profits tax. It was in the middle of the negotiations around BEPS 1.0, which were negotiations about how to sort of refine taxing rights in order to prevent what was then a perceived avoidance, some double non-taxation happening. And the big call to action in BEPS 1.0 was if we don't do this multilaterally, other countries are going to jump ahead and take unilateral action. But the UK did just that right in the middle of those negotiations with its diverted profits tax. And that tax is easily described as being in contravention of our treaties because the whole point of the tax is to say you have a taxing nexus in this jurisdiction because you've avoided having a taxing nexus in this jurisdiction. And that permanent establishment standard in our tax treaties was designed to create an objective as close to bright line as you could get so that companies could plan and understand when they triggered taxing nexus in a jurisdiction. And the UK kind of came on top and said, hey, if you plan to not have taxing nexus in a jurisdiction, we'll find that you have taxing nexus in a jurisdiction. So I think it's pretty easy to describe all three of those taxes as extraterritorial, and then the DST also suffers from being discriminatory.
To bring it back to Capitol Hill then, we've all seen the numerous letters that we've gotten from Ways and Means Chairman Jason Smith, from Senate Finance Chairman Mike Crapo, others. So tell me if this is a fair complaint from them, and maybe this is specific to UTPR, but we cannot let another jurisdiction tax a U.S. multinational on income earned in the U.S. Is that a fair sort of criticism, at least of UTPR?
Yeah, I think there's no traditional taxing nexus that would say a sister company would impose taxing rights with respect to a U.S. affiliate simply because the U.S. affiliate's ETR was low compared to some Pillar 2 norm. That's not part of the traditional allocation of taxing rights. So I think this Congress thinks, hey, we weren't part of agreeing to any different allocation of taxing rights. And this takes away from our sovereignty to implement incentives and other things that might reduce the ETR below that holy 15.
And the UK was pretty clear with DST and DPT that they didn't like the allocation that they have today, and so they wanted to change the rules, and they wanted to change the rules unilaterally. And we've had multilateral discussions about whether or not we could change taxing rights in relation to large businesses, including tech, that haven't been concluded. But very clearly, countries have gone out by themselves and claimed those taxing rights through things like DST and DPT.
Alistair, I think that's helpful to bring us back to this new proposed 899, because it's basically a reaction to other countries having unilaterally, without the agreement of Congress at least, decided to impose taxing rights contrary to traditional treaties. And Congress is saying, okay, two can play at that game. Proposed 899 is the US's unilateral response that says we're going to impose our own taxing rights on companies that have a nexus to jurisdictions with these bad taxes. And we're going to impose those taxing rights regardless of what treaties would otherwise say. We're going to come on top of our treaties. And if you did it, tit for tat.
Well, let me ask you this question about 899. You know, this is our response, right? Now we know what we're mad at. Now we know why we're mad at. Now we've got 899, which is our proposal. Tell us how it works, you know, at a high level, Danielle. And then a follow-on question is, if we're mad about extraterritorial taxes, is this an extraterritorial tax, or would 899 not be viewed as that in terms of our response?
Well, let me tell you the mechanisms first, and then let's talk about extraterritoriality, because I think it varies for the mechanisms. This proposed 899 significantly combines two previous proposals that one could have viewed as competing retaliatory measures, and now they've been combined into this one proposal. So those two mechanisms, the first was incorporated in a 2023 Smith bill, and it would increase the U.S. tax rate by 5 percentage points a year for every year where we have the problematic tax in place on outbound flows of U.S. source income. So that'd be like dividends, interest, royalties coming out of the U.S., as well as on trader business income, branch income that another company might have that is operating in the United States through a branch. So it incrementally increases the taxes on those flows. I wouldn't call that extraterritorial. The U.S. has the right to tax that income under traditional taxing norms, but in some of our treaties, we have negotiated away that right, and this comes on top of those treaties to impose the additional tax. So although it doesn't say it in the bill, because that would be a problem in reconciliation, I think we all understand the intention is that it would override treaties. Now, one improvement in this version of the bill is that it now seems to be clear that if, for example, the current status of our treaties is that we would have a zero rate on one of those flows, the rate would just step up by 5% each year, as opposed to first yanking the treaty rate, starting at the statutory rate of 30, which is a big cliff effect increase, and then adding the 5. So that's, I think, a clarification consistent with probably the original intent, but it's certainly a welcome clarification. So I wouldn't call that extraterritorial, but it is a treaty override. The second mechanism, I like to call it super beat, and it is a mechanism that's going to apply to the U.S. affiliate of groups that have a nexus to a bad country. And we should come back and talk about how we determine when you have the nexus to the, I'm calling them bad countries, but it's countries with one of the bad taxes. Superbeat would say any U.S. affiliate with that nexus to a bad country is automatically in BEAT, is going to pay BEAT tax at the elevated rate, the 12.5%. And this bill, you know, as a starting place, has extended the current BEAT tax of 10%. But if you're in the super BEAT, you're at a 12.5% rate. And then it makes certain other adjustments to BEAT to make it much more onerous. And in particular, I'd call out, it takes away an important exception for low-cost services that was a really significant out for a lot of companies when they were first adapting, when BEAT first entered the scene. In 2018, a lot of companies did a lot of work to confirm that a lot of their U.S. companies' outbound payments would qualify as these sort of low-cost routine services. One of the most significant changes is they take that away. There are a number of other changes, all of which make it more favorable. One, improvement, I'd say, over the earlier version of this part of the measure is an earlier version would have denied half of cost of goods sold. That would just be the death knell to certain low margin importers. But this version dials that back quite significantly and instead would just say, hey, if you're importing goods, you can have the purchase price of the goods, but we're not going to let you exclude from BEAT any additional amounts like overhead costs that would otherwise have been a BEATable payment, but you're capitalizing them into the inventory. Essentially, for the tax nerds out there, the 263 Cap A costs that can get capitalized into inventory would no longer be excluded from BEAT. So those are the two measures that are the punishments in this bill. They're really two very different mechanisms. And then the other question is sort of who is going to suffer those punishments? And a refinement as compared to the earlier version, particularly of the Super BEAT bill, is that these punishments, these higher tax rates, more onerous BEAT rules, would now be pointed at a group that's parent entity or an intermediate parent entity is located in a jurisdiction that has one of those bad taxes, or the actual payment in the case of those elevated rates is going to an entity that is located in a jurisdiction with a bad tax. Now we're only aiming at companies that are headquartered in the bad tax jurisdictions or actually operating in the bad tax jurisdictions and not more randomly at groups that anywhere in the group has an entity that is subject to a bad tax.
Got it. Okay, so two different mechanisms here. The first one, increasing the rate, as you said, on income that's already subject to tax in the U.S., I guess. So hard to argue that's extraterritorial or treaty point aside, right? The super BEAT, we already have the BEAT. So if that's extraterritorial, well, it's already. But we are making it substantially more burdensome to certain taxpayers. Okay. If we view 899 as a response to these actions by other jurisdictions, then should we expect a reaction from those jurisdictions to 899? So if that's true, if we think that that's true, what options might be available to them in response if 899 were to become law?
If this were to become law, you've got three responses. The one is countries concede. They take off the taxes that they have that the US views as discriminatory or extraterritorial. So for the UK, we get rid of the DST, we get rid of DPT, and we get rid of the UTPR. And that would take us outside the scope of these measures. The second is you don't concede. You just leave the tax in place and you say there are consequences to that, but I'm willing for my multinationals to bear those consequences. And I understand that. Or the third is they retaliate, they re-up. They say the US has done this and we're going to respond and we're going to do that by doubling the DST rate or doubling down on the UTPR, whatever that might be. You can think about whether or not there's a fourth response. So we know US Treasury have been very explicit, the OECD have been explicit, the EU have been explicit, that there are currently negotiations ongoing about how Pillar 2 should operate and interact with the US tax system. And so when we're thinking about what might happen to the UTPR, those negotiations are going to be really, really important and relevant. But the idea that there's space for negotiation if 899 becomes law is a misnomer or misleading, because 899 specifies very, very clearly what US Congress needs to take off the table its retaliatory measures. And so it doesn't really seem like there's space for other countries to come back in and say, well, we're kind of willing to meet you 75% of the way, but we'd like to keep this 25% of this thing that you don't like. 899 doesn't really create space for that, at least in respect of those measures that are identified as per se unfair foreign taxes.
All right, so either if it exists, it triggers it. It's not a question of degree. If it exists, it triggers 899. Let me ask you a question on the concession point. How broad does that concession have to be? For example, on UTPR, would it be enough to say, we're not getting rid of our UTPR, we're just excluding the application to the US? Would that be enough to turn off 899?
So we've got the UTPR safe harbor at the minute, which takes out of scope of Pillar 2 the US income of US parenting groups. Extending that is not going to be enough. This bill would require that where you have US parent and multinationals, that none of the entities that form part of that group are subject to the UTPR. So you need to go beyond the UTPR safe harbor. You need to start excluding wholesale US multinationals.
Got it. That's interesting. Okay. So it has to be more than just like, okay, never mind US, you're out. They'd have to go further. on the negotiation point, how does the timing of this bill impact that, right? If we were to go into negotiations, when this bill passes, Congress has said they'd love to do it by 4th of July. If you're skeptical, probably with good reason, that it would pass by 4th of July. But is their goal at least to pass it this summer? Failing that, then maybe by end of year. But how does any of the timing of enactment of 899 impact the ability to negotiate around this?
The rules around timing in the bill are reasonably complicated, and you really need to write it down on a piece of paper to understand how everything interacts. But the first thing to look at is, when is the bill enacted? Because when that bill enacted, the clock's going to start. After 90 days, the retaliatory measures then have the potential to kick in. So while this bill is under discussion, there is still time for the country to negotiate. The bill will have no effect. When the bill is enacted, there's still time. There's still 90 days for them to discuss before the bill potentially affects. And then after those 90 days, in respect of unfair foreign taxes that are already in place, what we're going to see then is the modified BEAT apply, and apply immediately if taxpayers have a tax year that begins after that 90-day window. For the increase in tax rates, it's a little bit more complicated. There, the increase in tax rates only start for the calendar year after the date that's 90 days after enactment. So if you got to enactment on the 4th of July, what that would mean is that by the beginning of October, the applicable date for the bill would kick in. And therefore, we would have tax rate increases from January 1, 2026. And so if you've got calendar year taxpayers, the tax rate increases are going to apply from there. But if you were to see the bill take longer to agree, so if we weren't to get to an agreement before the end of the year, then the applicable date would fall into 2026, and those tax rate increases would then only come into effect for 1 January 2027, and so we would see that delay by the year. So when the bill comes into effect, and particularly where that is in relation to the 31st of December, that's going to become really, really important.
I imagine if I'm finance minister outside the US or something, I'm looking at this proposal from the House, and I'm asking myself, or maybe people around me, how likely is it to pass? I think a really important data point that we don't have yet is, what is the Senate going to do? Because if we then get a Senate, let's imagine this passes the House in the next week or so, then we wait for a Senate bill. If it's in the Senate bill, I think that is the point at which the rest of the world probably says, okay, we need to take this seriously. And then they'd start developing their negotiating strategy, it seems like. But at this point here on, what is it, May 15th, probably a lot of people are asking with good cause, is this actually going to happen? And until you're pretty confident it is, I don't know that you begin to negotiate around this question. Let's conclude with another really important question. To recap where we've been, what is it that has made Congress sort of upset about this? Why? What are they going to do about it? What would the rest of the world do about it? But now let's ask this really important question. If 899 is designed to do this thing, sort of retaliate against those unfair tax measures, do we think it does a good job at that now that we've finally gotten our hands on the legislation? Danielle, what do you think on that?
I think this version of the bill includes a lot of improvements over the prior versions of these proposals that we've seen. For one, with respect to the under-tax profits rule, this version of the bill really aligns with Treasury's negotiating position right now. And that's in contrast to earlier versions of the bill. Under this version of the bill, if a country would, they don't have to completely eliminate their UTPR. They just have to ensure that their UTPR will not apply to any U.S. company or U.S. group. And as Alistair points out, that does include foreign subsidiaries under that U.S. group. So it is an expansion of the current UTPR safe harbor that would have to be negotiated. But that is currently Treasury's negotiating position. So if you are going to have a threat standing behind Treasury's negotiating position, it's good for it to be aligned with Treasury negotiating position. Treasury is, of course, asking for a lot of other things in the negotiations, including how the income inclusion rule will apply to U.S. companies, maybe some changes to how QDMTT ordering rules work. But I don't think it's a criticism of this bill that they don't take on everything Treasury is trying to negotiate. Kind of to Alistair's point, you wouldn't want to necessarily create a total zero-sum game with these kinds of threats behind it. This is a pretty strong response. And I think the most offensive thing and the biggest problem Treasury is trying to solve is the UTPR. It doesn't mean those other policies are not important. The other thing that I'd say makes this more fit for purpose, if you think that hanging these threats out there is a good idea, and I'm kind of neutral on that question, but something that makes this more fit for purpose is if you are going to use the U.S. taxing system to sort of hold companies hostage in the hope that other countries will say, oh, don't do that to my company. This increases my willingness to fold in this negotiation. You know, if you're taking hostages, you better make sure you're taking hostages that the people you're negotiating with care about. And prior versions of particularly the Estes bill I mentioned earlier were extremely broad in that the hair trigger to be in that bill was included bad acts by just countries that happen to have an operation in it. And I don't think that would get the attention of necessarily a country that you're trying to negotiate. What does get their attention is if you start making it very onerous for their national champions to operate successfully in the United States, to have subsidiaries in the United States, have investments in the United States, and have significant operations in the United States. Getting at their national champions or getting at countries operating in the United States, I think, is a more focused approach to the bill. And you don't want collateral damage that isn't consistent with trying to achieve the goal. Because I think the only way for any of us as tax practitioners to feel good about something like this being out there is if we believe that it will never apply because we believe it will be effective in achieving its stated objectives. So maybe just the last point I would make is just around the timing that Alistair was mentioning. I think it would be good for Congress and the Senate as they think about this to make sure that they're providing appropriate room for this bill to achieve its desired effects depending on when it's implemented. And maybe that means giving Treasury some authority that if they're getting very close to be able to pull back without requiring that for the three timers that we talked about, maybe they haven't managed to fully repeal all three of those taxes because other countries' legislative processes also take time. I sort of wish there was a little more room on the back end for Treasury to recognize that significant progress is being made and not pull the trigger on these provisions.
So something that Danielle and I have experienced from our time working for UK and US Treasury and for me at the OECD is that the discussions around the taxation of tech businesses was something that was put on hold for a long time until other countries introduced DSTs. And that forced the US to come back to the table because it required a response. And at the time, it was the first Trump administration, and they decided that their response was to negotiate. What we've seen on that front is just that those negotiations have taken a long time and ultimately not achieved the objective they wanted to, which is to remove the DSTs from the table. So countries have been effective at changing the way that taxing rules work, and the US has been ineffective at negotiating to remove those changes. 899 is a kind of finger on the scale, which has the potential to change the dynamic of those negotiations, including in relation to Pillar 2, and so get you to a different outcome. Like Danielle, I am concerned about the timeline because these negotiations are going to be complicated, they're going to be difficult, people are going to want time to think through and reflect, and there's a bit of time baked into this bill, but there's not lots of time. And so there's this threat that you actually see this stuff start to kick in where maybe nobody really wants it to apply in practice.
I think that's such an interesting observation. The digital services taxes in part were designed to get to the U.S. to the table, have a response. But the classic example of the law and unintended consequences is that the ultimate response that we get, wow, it's really an escalation of all this. Well, one last question. We've covered so much ground, but let's just bring it back to the 899 legislative proposal. I was a little surprised at the revenue estimate. A lot of this is policy driven. Yes, you know, Congress agrees with the policy, but a lot of it's about the money, right? This is a reconciliation bill. They need the money. To me, as a non-international tax expert, I thought this proposal would have raised a lot of money. When you talk about increasing the rate by 20% on U.S. income, these really onerous changes to the beat, I thought we'd get a lot. We got about $117 billion over 10 years. And interestingly, in that revenue estimate, the revenue estimate goes negative in the later years and more negative as we go. And if we'd gone beyond 10 years, it might get really negative. Anybody surprised by that revenue estimate, or do you think it's consistent with the statute as we see it? I'm not asking you to get in the heads of the revenue estimates at joint tax because that's impossible, but just I'm curious in your take.
I guess I was surprised to see it go negative in the out years. And the only thing I can speculate, I mean, you tell me, you've been in this business longer, the only thing I can speculate is that the revenue estimators are assuming a behavioral response that would drive less investment in the United States. Maybe we need to state the obvious, which is the revenue estimators are assuming an altered version of reality, which is that no country responds to this by changing their laws. So the whole idea of a revenue estimate of this, at least in my sort of optimistic view of this proposal, that it's going to be able to achieve some of its intended effect, at least at a minimum with respect to all those 30 UTPR jurisdictions. I realize the DST and DPD debate is a more complicated one, but I would expect that those 30 UTPR jurisdictions will respond to this proposal, and we won't see any of that revenue collected. But the view of the world that JCT takes is that they don't, and so their laws don't change, and so we end up collecting this revenue. I have to guess that they're assuming that if the U.S. started hiking up by 5 percentage points a year, the rate on dividends and the rate on interest into the U.S., that at some point they're assuming there'd be less investment in the U.S. And the cap on that, by the way, for treaty jurisdictions, even though that treaty jurisdiction might currently have 0 or a 5% rate, it tells you it's capped at the statutory rate, which would typically be 30% plus 20%. So a 50% rate on returning capital, like through dividends and interest, that's on top of having already paid the corporate tax, assuming it's like a corporate sub making those payments. I'm guessing that the negatives reflect JCT's thinking that eventually this will result in multinationals choosing to limit their operations in the U.S. because of that onerous effect. The second point I would just make is, you'll remember from 2017, I don't remember what the numbers were, but there was a revenue estimate associated with BEAT that I think our sense as practitioners is that it may not have been fully realized, because companies really figured out how to plan around BEAT. And there may be an assumption that taking the rate up to 12.5 and eliminating some of those exceptions, that companies will again institute planning to try to avoid some of the rougher edges of super BEAT.
All super valid points. Alistair, what do you think?
It was pretty shocking that this is forecast to raise $30 billion a year by 28, and by 2034, it's going to lose $8 billion a year. I think it must be the behavioral impact that companies are, you know, how they like to respond. But then I look at some of the things I've heard from businesses I've spoken to, and they're already thinking about whether they'd be cutting dividends and how hard they'd be cutting dividends and how hard they could to cut dividends. And I think when you look at this kind of measure and how penal it is, people are really going to be wanting to think about that response quickly if it comes into effect, because this is not a soft retaliatory measure. This is a pretty hard retaliatory measure.
Yeah, I like the example of the BEAT revenue estimate is a good one. But I think our assumption there is, yes, the BEAT raises less or very little compared to what people thought, but that revenue shows up somewhere else. Because of the planning around the BEAT makes it appear other places, and it's hard to know where. And maybe that's part of what's going on with this negative estimate. So if I'm a multinational doing business in the U.S., maybe I sell my U.S. operations, right, and I just get out. But then that income, it's not like the income goes away, but perhaps it shows up somewhere else that it's just hard to know. But it is a really curious thing, and maybe we'll learn more about that, how joint tax estimated this over time. Well, both of you, thank you very much. Fascinating discussion, and there's going to be more on this. Our good friends at Inside International Tax are no doubt planning a deeper dive in the technical aspects of these provisions. But Danielle, Alistair, thank you for your time today. In closing, let's keep this short. Boy, we've said a lot today, and I know this is a complex topic, but I wanted to discuss this proposal with you because it really has so many interesting angles. One is as a revenue raiser. Another as a way for congressional Republicans to push back against Pillar 2. Another angle is a way to protect the taxing sovereignty of the U.S. And, well, another one is to protect the tax-writing sovereignty of the legislative branch. Now, if you want to learn more on this topic, I cannot recommend more Danielle's encyclopedic analysis of these proposals in her recent Tax Notes article, which I'm sure you can find online. Now, for the last time, let me reiterate, I hope it was clear we are not saying retaliatory measures are either good policy or bad policy. It's for Congress and, well, the lobbyists, I suppose, to make those arguments. We just wanted to outline what the proposal is, why it is, and how it might work. But my last thought is this. Really, one of the most novel features about Section 899 is how rare it is for a revenue-raising provision such as this one to be designed to really raise zero revenue if its policy is successful. That's because if the rest of the world, for example, drops application of the UTPR to the U.S., well, then retaliation against the UTPR is turned off. Congress, I imagine, well, they would call that a victory. But then how does the proposal raise revenue? Well, this is the alternate reality that Danielle talked about. The revenue estimators at joint tax can't assume what will happen. They don't know what another jurisdiction or another legislature in another country will do. All they can see is that the UTPR is on the books in those countries around the world. But for now, forget alternate reality. We're living in a current reality. And that reality raises many questions. Can this provision become law? How much tax would it impose in reality on inbound companies? And how would they respond to those higher taxes? These are unanswerable questions today, but they are ones to ask as we steer into the legislative tempest that is the summer of 2025. With that, thanks again for tuning in to Catching Up on Capitol Hill. There is so much more to say, and I promise we'll say it soon. So look for our next episode. But until then, take care, and I hope to see you soon.